Hi, I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a two-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
And it's 11 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the bike show today, talking about cycle touring and numerous other topics. Today, helping you plan your summertime bike adventures and see more of the world on two wheels. KBOO keeps you informed and keeps you involved with your community, and we always need your help. You could go to kboo.fm, kboo.fm, and click where it says donate to become a member and help us out. Thank you very much. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybanks.coop.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. You've just tuned in to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studios in Southeast Portland, Oregon. I'm Terry Campbell here with fellow co-host Tori Bortman. Hi, Tori.
Good morning, Terry.
How's it going?
Excellent. A little hot and smoky outside, but other than that, really good. I'm glad to be here in the AC.
That's the truth. Today we'll be talking about bike touring. Bike touring is as old as the bike itself. From the first time a person pushed, pedaled, or rode a two-wheeled machine, the curiosity about what lies over the next hill, in the neighboring county, or around that corner has driven cyclists to explore. There is something beautiful about the speed at which one explores our planet when done by bike. It's much faster than walking, and yet slower than the automobile. However, you can cover great distances and absorb more of your surroundings when riding a bike. Cycle touring finds its genesis in the second half of the 19th century, when penny farthings and velocipedes ruled the roads. As anyone can see, the cyclists of that era were a much hardier lot than those of today's as the machines were in their early development and they lacked many of the comforts that are taken for granted by today's cyclists. Alas, that did not stop riders of the day from setting off on some epic adventures. For 2 years, Thomas Stevens, a writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, set off around the world in 1884 on a 50-inch Columbia with a money belt, a revolver, two shirts, and a rain cape. For those interested, Mr. Stevens wrote a lengthy book about his journey called Around the World on a Bicycle. Not to be outdone, a mother of three and wife, Annie Londonberry, circumnavigated the globe in 15 months, starting from Boston in June 1894. Using the newer developed safety bike, Annie became the first woman to circle the planet when she set off carrying only a change of clothes and a pearl-handled revolver, upping the gear ratio for sure. Written by Peter Zutlin, Around the World on Two Wheels, Annie Londonderry's extraordinary ride shares many of the stories about her adventure. However, all adventures need not circle the planet to be fun or an adventure. Adventure is defined as engaging in hazardous and exciting activity, especially when exploring unknown terrain. Now, if we break this definition down and accept the fact that our daily lives are filled with hazards that we attempt to minimize, then what adventure really is an exciting opportunity to explore unknown territory, people, and places. This exploration allows us to better understand our world and gives us a deeper appreciation for all the things that make it work and not work. So for some, an adventure could consist of loading up the kids in a cargo bike for the first time and taking them to a farmer's market. While for others, it could mean riding across the country in 3 months. In the first part of today's show, we'll be talking with Alex Phillips, Bike and Waterways Coordinator at Oregon State Parks, where she leads the Scenic Bikeways program. In the second part of today's show, we will invite Zach Hamm and Kevin KPR Prentice from Ride with GPS to help us understand how to get out on our adventures in the right direction. First off, Alex Phillips has an extensive experience bike touring and that started way back in 1990, and she is currently the program manager for the Scenic Bikeway program. Alex was hired by State Parks and Recreation 9 years ago this month to start the first in the country bikeway program. Along with the bikeway committee, she created the program from crafting the criteria of rating potential bikeways, convincing the Oregon Department of Transportation to adopt the bikeway sign into the official sign code, building strong local proponent groups for newly adopted bikeways, and promoting the program internationally. Scenic bikeway routes are the very best road biking in Oregon, nominated by locals and carefully rated and selected by the State Parks and Recreation Department. All designated routes have descriptional signs, directional signs, printable maps, cue sheets, and GPS info. From mild rides to extreme, everyone can find a ride that fits their style. All you need is a bicycle and a spirit of adventure. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show, Alex. Thanks for joining the conversation.
It's great to be here.
First off, I guess maybe could you just give us a little bit of background on this idea about scenic bikeways? Was it something that Parks and Rec was already looking at before you came on, or did you join the agency and then kind of develop the idea?
They already had the idea, and actually the vision for the idea really came from Cycle Oregon, who was in communication with State Parks and with ODOT way back when, talking, this is like 2005, 2006, when even before I started, when they started with the vision and kind of ideas on how it would work.
How did it end up being a State Parks project instead of, I don't know, the Oregon Department of Transportation or something like that? Like, how did it fall under their umbrella?
That's a good question, because that was really a hot topic for a while. At one point, it was going to be funded by State Parks and ODOT, but housed at Cycle Oregon. And then they thought, no, it'll be housed at ODOT. But then, because of the recreation piece of this, it's about bicycle recreation, that it just made sense to have it at State Parks. So there was really lots of conversation before it ended up at State Parks.
That's interesting, because it's not really a state, like it's not in one location that is necessarily connected to a state park.
That's true. And we do, State Parks does have other programs like that that are not in state parks, like our historic program. The Historic Preservation Program is within state parks, and our Main Street program that works with different main streets throughout Oregon also are not in state parks. So a lot of people think, you know, it's state parks and recreation. So I'm in the and recreation part.
Got it. You kind of forget that part. I know from some of the routes from personal experience that they connect some state parks. Is that done intentionally to kind of highlight that you can connect these by bike?
Yes, the most important part of choosing a route is finding the scenic route, and when it works to start or go past a state park or any park, it really, of course, helps the route. People like to stop or ride by state parks, and there's so many amenities at state parks with the bathrooms and the water.
Yeah, I was going to say water and bathrooms tend to be key.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Great. So how did you get into bike touring?
Well, actually, so the story is, I was riding to work, this is way back in 1990, and I was riding some, mostly mountain biking for recreation, and I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and I was talking to my best friend who was living in Bozeman, Montana, and I was saying, and I'd been drinking a little bit, and I'd been saying how I really wanted to drive up there, but 10 hours sitting in a car. Even then, it would just sound so uncomfortable. And like I said, I'd been drinking a little. And I said, I know, I'll just ride my bike.
I'll just. Yeah. Famous last words.
Yeah. And the next morning, I was like, what did I say? And then someone told me about Adventure Cycling Association and their maps. So I bought one of their maps, and that's how I did it.
And so you just started off on your own, just maybe read a little bit from or learned from some friends, but you went solo the first trip.
I went solo the first trip. I barely knew how to change a flat. Luckily, I didn't get a flat. I was on a mountain bike with two little panniers, and it worked out amazingly, yeah.
That's so good. That's I love those first adventures. Mm-hmm. Where else did your touring take you?
After that, I did, living in Montana, I did some big tours around Montana. I also did a two-month-long tour. This was way back in 1994, which is on, now people would call it gravel grinding at the time. I just called it just following whatever dirt roads I could find all through Arizona, Utah, and Colorado.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was all on dirt roads for 2 months.
It must not have been rainy season, hopefully.
No, I mean, that's mostly high desert. So, Okay. Yeah, it was very, very sandy. And then I actually also bike toured in Cuba.
Oh, excellent. When did you do that?
That was 2006.
Okay, so that was before, but that was when you had to get there through Mexico. Minute.
Yeah, and maybe I should actually say that I cannot confirm nor deny.
Right.
You may have been in Cuba riding your bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had some friends tour in Cuba earlier this year, and the one fellow got a lung infection because of the leaded gasoline was the culprit, apparently, and riding next to all those older cars got the better of them, and in the end actually made their mileage, you know, not be as ambitious. But
right there, that's a great example of the adventure we're kind of trying to explore today on the bike show, of like sometimes you go to places and unexpected things come up. What unexpected things have come up for you, Alex?
Oh boy, let's see. There's just so many things.
I know. Which one, are there any that particularly make your stomach like twist or be like,
Actually, the first thing that's coming to mind is actually a really good thing, not a bad thing. And I was on that tour way out in the middle of nowhere. I was in Goblin Valley State Park, which is a Utah state park.
Which there sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was beautiful. And there's no one there. I mean, really, no one there. I went into the bathroom. There's a little, you know, pit toilet kind of thing. And I come back out, and there's another touring bike leaning against the wall. And I just couldn't believe it. And then the guy who had the touring bike, this guy named AJ, walks out, and he couldn't believe that I was there. And so we toured together for a couple of days. That was great. It's so amazing the things that can happen on a bike tour. I'm actually blanking out on a negative story right now. Maybe something will come up. Here's another one that happened when I was riding to Montana, and this fits with what the intro to this thing was about, how fast you're traveling on a bike. Is I was coming up to, I think it's called Landmark Rock, and there's a big sign that said that, and it was on the Oregon Trail, that wagon trains could see the rock for a day coming and a day going, and cars could see it for 10 minutes coming and 10 minutes going, and I could see it for an hour both ways. But as I'm passing the rock, this guy pulls over so fast, he just swerves off the road, and I think, oh no, I'm going to be, something bad's going to happen. He pulls off the road in the middle of Wyoming, unrolls his window, and says to me, "Do you know where you are? This is a historic place." He gives me the whole story.
He's like, it's time to get educated right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. Impromptu lecture. Starting now. That's great. So the Scenic Bikeways, what year did we get the first one in Oregon?
Well, the very first one was really officially 2005, but it didn't get signed and mapped and all that. The Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway did not get signed and mapped until 2009.
And where does that run, for our listeners who aren't familiar, where does that kind of roughly run from and to?
The northern terminus is Shampooey State Park. It's 135 miles, and it goes all the way to Armitage County Park, which is just north of Eugene. It runs all along the east side of the Willamette River, and there's a couple different places where you can access it by Amtrak.
Oh, yes. Excellent. I didn't know that part.
That's excellent. So you can do it out and back by Amtrak, huh?
Exactly.
And then how many others have come along, and do they cover the whole state, or are they sort of centered in a few areas? Or?
Well, they're starting to cover the whole state. We have 16 now. We have a bunch in eastern Oregon, some in central Oregon, and we have one up in our newest one is in Maupin. We also have the Tualatin Valley Scenic Bikeway and one on the coast called Wild Rivers Coast Scenic Bikeway.
And where's Maupin? I feel like I should know this.
Actually, I'm really glad you said that, because most people don't know where Maupin is, even longtime Oregonians.
Isn't it in the gorge?
Past the gorge. It's really just an hour and a half, 2 hours from Portland, and it's on the Deschutes River.
Okay.
And keep it in mind, because when it starts pouring in Portland, it can be dry and sunny in Maupin. It's a beautiful late fall, winter riding place.
Excellent. Oh, I'm already excited. It might just be the 107-degree day, but you're already making me pine for fall.
For rain. Cooler temps. So what's the story with the new one in Maupin? And when was it sort of announced and signed? And what's the profile of the ride?
Well, as with all of them, the local proponents organized and submitted the route during an application process. And we do it that way for two reasons, because the locals know the best roads, and also to have that local involvement is so important to making the route really come alive and making the community bike friendly. And they applied in 2015. The Bikeway Committee goes out and rated it that same summer, and actually it was a day like this. There was fires. It was really hot. We were out there rating it. But of course, loving it, and it was it's about a 30-mile loop that starts in Maupin. It goes past White River State Park, White River Falls State Park, with a beautiful waterfall, and then it also goes past the namesake of the route, Shears Falls, which is actually land owned by the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and you can see Warm Springs tribal members fishing in traditional ways there, and then it goes up along the Deschutes River back to Maupin. So it's a wonderful day ride.
That sounds beautiful.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it's all on road.
It is all on pavement, yes. All on road. We have two bikeways. Parts of them are on paved pathways.
Got it.
And do you have a favorite scenic bikeway?
Well, I don't know.
It's hard to choose just one.
It is, but I have to tell you that I do love the ones that are more open and more desert-like, and it's always a discussion on the Bikeway Committee, the rating team, because some people say, like I'll say, oh, it's so beautiful, I can see forever, it's so open here, where other people will say, it's so brown and there's no trees, and they're the ones that love, like, the Cascading Rivers one, which is over by Detroit and Estacada, where you can see all the big, beautiful trees and the greenery that Western Oregon is famous for.
So the process, is it grassroots in that the communities apply to you guys, or are you out kind of seeking applicants, or a little bit of both? It sounds like a very grassroots process for getting these, would be really nice.
It is very grassroots. We put it out there when we have an application window, and we don't have one right now, actually. But when we do, and we just try to get the word out all over the state and make it easy for community groups to apply, but it's really for them to put in the route and work together. They also, when they apply, they need to have letters of support from all the road jurisdictions. And that could be city, county, ODOT, Forest Service.
That sounds complicated.
It is a little complicated, but it's why we're able to put the signs up and different road jurisdictions. And it is a lot of work.
You'd think it was just a sign, but it's never just a sign, is it?
No, and that's why I mentioned that. I had that in my intro, because it sounds like it's, oh, well, it's just a sign. Well, let's just design a sign. No, it has to go through this big ODOT process. And I have to say that having ODOT in support of the bikeways as a partner with the bikeways and allowed us to, you know, and they adopted our sign, is what sets Oregon apart from all the other states. There's many other states that are trying to have a bikeway program like this, but their Department of Transportation is not as open to this idea.
Yeah, you've got to have buy-in from the stakeholders of, and in this case, Oregon Department of Transportation is a rather large and looming stakeholder, considering how much control of our roads that they have.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though. How is it working with the National Forest? Are they often pretty easy to work with as well?
They're very approachable. The issue with working with the Forest Service is that, you know, they're a federal agency, and they always want to look to something to make a decision. They don't want to be just going out there and being arbitrary and capricious or whatever lawyers say. They want to have something to back up their decisions, and right now there really isn't something they can lean towards. We were actually...
So they want like another example and saying, oh, here in Montana, this road worked great, but because we're at the front of the development, they don't have another example to look towards, kind of thing?
Exactly. So we're developing a guide. We got a grant. Actually, the Forest Service helped us apply for this grant to study the issues that often face the Forest Service. And we'll have that guidebook that the grant is allowing us to create will be available this fall for Oregon and for any other state that wants to look at something as some guidance on how you would say yes or no to a bikeway on the road jurisdiction that you're managing.
It sounds like a guidebook that will change 14 million times over before it's decided that that's the actual guidebook. Like, I don't know about that rule. I don't.
It's a start point. It's the first one, and I'm sure it'll go from there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the process sounds really great. I didn't know. I mean, it seems like it's in step with Cycle Oregon as far as, you know, getting buy-in from the communities where folks want to ride, and I think that's really important. So that's good to learn. I really like that.
As far as that buy-in goes, are you finding, you said it started in about 2006, are you finding, maybe it's through your own marketing, but it could also just be through, I know with ranching changing and with forestry changing, a lot of towns in Oregon are starting, and I think recently, I might be misquoted, but I'm pretty sure I heard recently that it's a $3 billion industry. Tourism is an outdoor recreation is a $3 billion industry in Oregon. Are you finding that towns want to buy in, are starting to approach you more, that they're more eager to be a part of the bikeway program or something, anything with the state parks?
Absolutely, we're finding that communities are coming to us, and as I said, we do not have an application window open right now, and they're really wanting to have a bikeway. But there's other ways to promote biking in their communities, and we're working with them on those ways to do that. And I'll just put in a plug for the next speaker. A great way to start is to put a really good route on Ride with GPS, and that way people can access the route and at least know, and you could put it on a website. But
got a thumbs up from Zach and Kevin on that one.
And I have to say that the other thing that really opened the door was Cycle Oregon, Bicycle Rides Northwest, all these event rides going out all over the state and showing rural communities that bicycling brings money to the town, and it's good. It's a good thing to have in your town.
Do you feel like there's definitely been a shift in that then?
Yes, a very slow but very noticeable shift, yes. And anyone who's going out bike touring on their own, they're also part of that shift.
So if you were, speaking of people bike touring by themselves, if you were to recommend a trip or how would you get started or recommend to one of our guests to get, or our listeners to get started on their own bike adventure?
Well, I'll talk about last summer. My old college roommate came out, and I took her on her very first bike tour ever. And there was a couple things that we did. First, we picked Sisters to Smith Rock. It's 35 miles one way with campgrounds on either end. So we drove over to Sisters, and one of the first things we did is we packed up our bikes and rode around Sisters a little bit. like, do we have everything we need? Is everything balanced right? Is all that like
AKA the shakedown ride?
Exactly. And she actually, I have to tell you, was very careful. You know, she didn't want to have any weight in her bag. But then, of course, she started sampling the Oregon Pinot Noir and decided that she needed to bring some Oregon Pinot Noir with her. So that was the only really heavy thing in her pannier. And we rode the 35 miles from Sisters to Smith Rock, which is, you know, people say, well, you got to do 50 miles a day or big hills, but you don't. And we took our time. We just hung out. We looked at the birds. We looked at the sights. And then we camped at Smith Rock State Park. We actually spent an extra day there, went hiking, and then rode back. And a lot of people don't like the idea of an out and back. But I have to tell you, she stopped me at one point and said, are we on the right road? This looks totally different than the way it did yesterday.
Yeah, because your views change and your perspectives change. And so there's things that you didn't notice. I had an experience like that this weekend on a mountain bike where I was like, wait, where am I? Because I thought I should see a view. And then in another place, I was like, where did that come from? How did I totally miss that on the way out? But there it was.
Exactly. So for first time bike tour, just start out with reasonable miles, get a bike that fits, a seat that fits, and don't take too much stuff.
And what about, let's say this is very fictional, I'm married, I've got kids, maybe not a bike tour. What is another adventure that I could recreate or check out in the Oregon State Parks by bike?
Oh, so a really great thing to do actually is on, there's two. There's the Covered Bridges Scenic Bikeway, which is not in a state park, but that's a really flat paved trail that starts in Cottage Grove. There's lots of bathrooms and water along it, and you could just do as an out and back with kids on bikes for as many or as few miles as you want. And also in Oregon State Parks, there's at Champuy State Park, there is a pathway that's only a couple miles that goes through the park and along the river and then pokes out at the tiny little town of Butteville, and you can go get some ice cream there.
Oh,
that's great.
That's and Champuy has camping as well, so you can
bike only.
Champuy has
bike camper. Yeah, that's great. So we're running out of time, but before we leave you, I would like to ask you to briefly describe what the Scenic Waterways Coordinator also does, because Tori and I were both, given the heat, we want to know where we can get on a scenic waterway.
And I knew they existed, but I think it's a pretty unique program to Oregon, is it not?
Yes, and actually, I have to say, it sounds just like scenic bikeways, but it is not. It is actually a protection put on waterways. So it is not promotional. If you're looking for places to float the river, it's actually better to go to other sites and Google water trails. And actually, the Willamette Water Keepers is River Keepers. The Willamette River Keepers is a great place for information. They're a nonprofit out of Portland. But it's about protecting rivers, and we're actually looking at a study right now on a section of the Nehalem River that may be to see if it should be designated, to recommend it for designation. But it's a whole different can of worms.
Got it.
It's interesting because how I know about it is because I have a friend who works for the Willamette River Keepers, and she had spoken about they do a lot of cleanup on the rivers, and she's always posting about that. And it was cool, but there are other river trails that you can take as well, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I didn't even know that existed. That's
excellent.
Awesome.
Well, before we leave you today, what are some ways that folks can find out about the scenic bikeways and the different maps? What's the best website or social media outlet?
Thanks for asking. So if you just go to OregonScenicBikeways.org, that's OregonScenicBikeways.org, you get the printable maps, you get cue sheets, turn-by-turn cue sheets, and the GPS, which of course will send you right to Ride with GPS, and also the 16 bikeways, designated bikeways, are broken into mild, moderate, challenging and extreme categories. So you can find
extreme.
Yes. And also, Travel Oregon, another partner of ours, has made videos of each of the bikeways, 2-minute little videos, so you can really get a feel for which bikeway is the right one for you.
And I'm super excited. It was really great having you on. I have to tell you a little story that the first time I worked with the program of our next guest, The Ridge with GPS, I actually ended up on a scenic bikeway in Bend. Mm-hmm. And I hit both those things and I was like, this is the best app ever and I'm on a scenic bikeway. And it was the first non-intentional scenic bikeway that I've been on. So it was very exciting.
Yeah, they are.
Great. And we appreciate really all the work that you guys do.
Yeah.
I appreciate you getting the word out on it.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today, Alex. Hopefully we'll see you out on one of those bikeways someday in the future.
That would be great. All right.
Take care.
You
stay
too,
tuned.
Yeah.
During the next part of the show, we will be joined by Zach Hamm and Kevin KPR Prentice from Ride with GPS to help us understand how to get off on our adventures in the right direction. We'll be back shortly. We've been joined by Zach Hamm and Kevin Prentice of Ride with GPS. Ride with GPS is a Portland, Oregon-based online mapping and mapping website that allows people to find pre-existing rides, map their own rides, and connect with a network of other riders. Zach is one of the two founders of Ride with GPS. He began working on this passion project that would eventually become his company while still in college. At the time, Zach was looking for a way to create and share motorcycle routes, but he became interested in bicycles soon after. Now the focus of Ride with GPS is squarely on cycling, and the company has grown to include 13 employees. Zach is a mountain biker who enjoys riding at local hotspots like Black Rock and Sandy Ridge, but also enjoys epic road and gravel rides. He once climbed Old Germantown Road 13 times in one sitting, and even climbed Newberry Road, a very steep road in Northwest Portland, on a unicycle. When he's not working or riding, Zach enjoys helping his wife with her baking business, hanging out with their dogs, and riding dirt bikes in the forest. Kevin Prentice started working at Ride with GPS in 2013. Since that time, he's become an integral part of the company and now is the Director of Support and Business Development. A self-described average cyclist and a technology enthusiast, his work with Ride with GPS has allowed him to blend these two interests to help riders create and live out inspiring experiences on their bike. In his spare time, Kevin enjoys hanging out with his wife and baby daughter, gardening, S240s, and taking rambling Saturday basket rides, preferably on gravel. Zach and Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Howdy. Thanks for having us here.
Great. Maybe give us a little bit of background, Zach, on that that passion you found in college. You were riding motorcycles. Was that in the Northwest? And how did you transition from motorcycle mapping to cycling mapping?
Sure. Yeah, when I was in college, I was a computer science major. I've been into computer stuff for really forever. And so we had a class project that was essentially build a piece of software for the entire term and try and make it something real. And so I think most people were doing projects that were sort of school-ish throwaway things, and I wanted to do something that was more interesting to me and legitimate. And so I worked on sort of the first version of Ride with GPS, where you could map out a route. At the time, I was riding motorcycles, mostly with a guy named Colin King, who's actually my business partner. And after finished that project, I went and called him up and asked if he wanted to keep working on it. And so then I had a boss. I was working at the university, and he was a cyclist and kind of got me into it. And so over the next year, I think I got Colin into cycling, and it just slowly transitioned there because cyclists really are more technology focused.
And were you cycling at that time, or just strictly motorcycling, or a little bit of both?
Both, you know, and we still ride motorcycles. Mm-hmm. It's just the, I don't know, the company's gotten more interesting from the cycling perspective than the motorcycling, just because you move at a slower speed. I think from a routing perspective, there's some more interesting problems to solve, and
what kind of problems, Zach?
You know, cyclists are looking, there's some similarities between motorcycling and cycling. You want to go out, and a lot of times you start at the same place you end, you know, and if you're in a car and you're getting from point A to point B, it's not really the same problem. You want to go out and see interesting things and come back. And so from a mapping perspective, that's fairly similar. But when you're actually on the bike, when you're on a motorcycle, you're just out riding realistically. But when you're on a bike, a lot of people want to gather data. They want to record the ride. They want to review it later.
Me personally, I need to know some elevation.
Of course.
That psychologically, some people don't want to know. For me, it helps to know what I'm getting into.
It's a huge part of planning a ride, and that's actually one of the biggest things that, you know, whenever you're starting anything with a small group of people, it's just Colin and myself for a long time, you have to pick sort of what you're going to be the best at and sort of be okay with being pretty good at everything else. And for us, the first thing that we chose to be the best at was elevation data. We actually sent off a hard drive to the USGS and harassed them for their free data set. This was years and years and years ago, because you couldn't download it online. You could only get it for a small area, you know, because they sent a shuttle mission over in like 2000, gathered, you know, over the whole world, a nice rich data set of.
But you can only get one section at a time.
Exactly. Unless you send them a big hard drive and wait a month or two and pay for the shipping and harass them constantly. And then finally it comes back in this data format that's like, what is this? and then we ended up building a service so we could serve out, you know, as you route, as you plan your route, you click along a map and an elevation profile instantly shows up. And we're the first people that did that. And it was sort of because we decided to be the best at that thing.
That's good. You got people like Tori on board right out of the gate.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I certainly don't like descending 2,000 feet only to find it's the wrong way either. So figuring out where things are is really helpful. Did the company start in Portland, and was the original mapping done here in the Northwest, or were you guys a different part of the country?
So both Colin and myself, we actually went to high school together, and we were riding motorcycles together back then. And then we both went off to college. And I started this my sophomore year, and I was down at U of O, and Colin was at OSU, also pursuing computer science. So we were keeping in touch and hanging out on weekends, and so that's how it started. Him in OSU, and me down in Eugene, and a lot of our original users that date back to like 2006, 2007. We'll still assume that we're down there, and sometimes we get, you know, emails or whatever, people touring and going through and being like, hey, you guys still in Eugene or Corvallis?
That's great. That's great. So you guys have been around for over 10 years then?
Yeah, just about, right about 10 years. I guess, yeah, a little bit more than 10 years. You know, we incorporated as a business in 2009, so anybody that's fact-checking will find that out. But yeah, about 10 years.
Great. And Kevin, when did you join the company, and what inspires you to go to work every day about Ride with GPS?
I came on in 2013. I was working a different job, full-time job, and I saw an ad posted, oh, part-time customer service for a bike online company. I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. And so I asked my wife, Ashley, he's like, hey, do you think it'd be okay if I came in after my full-time job and did this other part-time job? And she's like, well, no, obviously not. but somehow I did do it and found out. It took a long time because their office was unlisted at the time. But it turned out the office was literally around the corner from where I was.
Lovely.
So I was like, yes.
Well, then it's not like you're really leaving work.
Exactly. Right. It's just working just overtime all the time. Yeah. So
I did that. Okay if I work 80-hour weeks for a while?
Yeah. Just no. but did that for, I think, 5 months, and it was really cool, and it was, you know, I could tell that it was something that I could kind of attach myself to, and I could tell that it was, you know, really kind of not in its infancy back then, but there was a lot to do and a lot of cool stuff that was going on. I definitely wanted to be a part of it.
Nice. That's great. What kind of challenges do you guys come across, both from, and I'm not a computer scientist by any stretch, but from the kind of development side and also from the customer service side? Like, I mean, I know what? You guys have excellent customer service support when people email. My first-hand experience, people get back to you really quickly, but what are the kind of the common themes that people run into?
Yeah, Kevin, why don't you start?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes people come up to us and just say, hey, I got on this gravel road when I didn't really mean to get on this.
Wow. Yeah, I'm going to get an answer to my earlier question.
No.
Is there a way, I don't know that I've used it, is there a way to tell on the map if it's gravel or not?
There's besides plenty a ride description? Tools. We utilize Google Maps in the Route Planner, so we still have Street View available, so you can drag the little man icon and get a Street View.
Okay.
And for the most part, Google doesn't Street View gravel roads. Okay. So if you hold the little man over the map, all the roads will turn blue that you can drop it on for Street View. And the ones that aren't blue tend to kind of be unpaved. And then we also have Google Satellite View, where you can plan your routes in Google Satellite View. So that's what people use to figure out if they can take their skinny tires on those roads or not.
Yeah, and there is a default. There's a sort of default thing that pops up that lets you know that there's a challenge on the road you're trying to plan a trip around.
Yeah,
which,
if you do.
Sadly, I hit the X on that every time, well, and that's why I might wind up on a gravel road, but that's a separate thing.
So what's your probably most common complaint, and what's your most unusual? Do you have a comment? You're like, unusual? Well, where do we even start?
Well, I don't know.
For your listeners, the looks on their faces that they just exchanged was pretty classic.
I'll preface it by saying that we make really grandiose claims to our customers that are very difficult to live up to, but we try to. So we claim that we'll replace a dedicated cycling GPS unit, and a dedicated cycling GPS unit has a battery life of days, is waterproof, is mounted on your handlebars, and has a company like Garmin behind it. And so with a very small team, we've built a piece of software that people do use in all these ways. But sometimes it's a challenge. And when you expect to go out and ride, you know, be on your bike, put yourself in difficult situations for 8 or 10 hours for a lot of these people or longer, you're bound to run into some issues. And especially when the first thing you do is go on our website and plan a route or go take somebody else's route that who knows how well of a job they did planning it. And then you try and navigate it with our software and record and take pictures and connect to Bluetooth devices. So I'd say, you know, the core problem that people have is just they don't run through the right steps from our perspective. You know, like we're experts at using our software. And so we have a lot of blind spots around the places where people can get tripped up. And so...
Well, like that, you, Kevin, you very clearly said, oh, well, on Google Maps, as if everyone knows that if it's not blue on Google Maps, it's probably gravel.
Right.
And I didn't know that. So I'm like, oh, great, thanks. I learned something. But I wouldn't know that intuitively on your software.
Yeah, we have really rad stuff that can be complex in certain scenarios. So it's exactly what he said. It's... You know, I heard from my friends that this is really great and I want to use it and I know it'll be valuable. Where do I start?
Maybe kind of some of the fun stuff we get. Like we had somebody who wanted our help to analyze a recording that they did with our software with a heart rate monitor because they unfortunately got hit by a car and they went to court and wanted to use it as evidence in the case in like lawsuit.
Interesting.
So it's like, oh, that's fun.
Because it is evidence. Right. Like,
absolutely.
It says,
yeah, there's timestamps and you can look at when things were going and then when and the speed and then when they stopped.
Wow.
As well.
Wow.
And you're tracking exactly where you were.
Yep.
On the road.
Yep.
So right. If somebody says you were here riding on this side of the road and you're like, nope.
Nope.
No, I wasn't.
Right. Interesting.
And I want to point something out too, is you guys mentioned support and like all the different things that we encounter or whatever. One thing we did really early on, Cole and myself, is we wanted to be like real. We wanted a community. We wanted real people behind what we were building. We didn't want to just build this thing and put it out into the world like a lot of software is. And so every email, like whenever somebody signed up for a service, they'd get an email that's like, welcome to Ride with GPS. Thanks for signing up. And then it would be, you know, pick a flip a coin basically and decide whether to say, you know, sincerely, Zach Hamm, my phone number, my email address, or it would say Colin King, his phone number, his email address. And we did that for the first, I think, 10, 20, 30,000 users, something like that. And so we developed, we got a lot of emails, and we did it as long as we could. And then that's when we brought on Kevin. And now half our company is support. And that's been an operational challenge to build a software business around having like really expert support, really being proud of our response time and everything else. Because most companies just say, well, we haven't budgeted for that. We haven't built our business in a way to have one-on-one support for people that maybe don't pay us any money. So we really tried to stick to that ethos, which has given us interesting stories like this, right, and been a challenge.
That's great. How far afield do you have subscribe? It is a subscription service. Is that correct?
I mean, you can just sign up for free, and then people can, if you want more, you can pay to get more.
Okay.
I mean, it's worldwide. You can.
It's probably 60% United States, 40% outside of the United States.
So yeah, big international base.
Yeah, my actual very first time using your program, I was in Oregon. Excuse me. I was in Oregon. Yes. Illinois, a small town. Whoa. Outside, kind of near Dixon, Illinois. That's where my mom lives. It's Dixon is the hometown of Ronald Reagan. In any case, they decided, as it's a very small town, maybe 2,000 people, to make a bunch of routes and promote their town as a start and stop place for bike rides, for particularly for gravel bike rides. And this was interesting because it was before gravel was hot. Wow. They've done this, and they used your software as, so that's what got me there. Is I said, okay, well, there's all, because it's beautiful, it's not flat where they are, it's Kettle Moraine, which is where the glacier left big chunks of material, so it's actually really rolling and quite stunning. And that's how I found, actually, I was not in Oregon the state, I was in Oregon, Illinois, when I found Ride with GPS. So It's good to know you've got a good footprint, and you've got an entire municipality using your software for promoting their city.
Yeah, so yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we've got, I don't know, we work with a fair amount of tourism people around the country and kind of around the world, and I think our tools really lend well to those types of agencies and small communities, medium-sized communities. They have these great routes. They have all these great cycling experiences in a digital age, in a web age. And so, you know, we make tools to help you put that together and showcase it really well on your own site to draw those people to your community.
And for example, for our listeners, when I used this program, it also allows you to put an earphone or earphones in and gives you turn-by-turn directions. So I chose to take one of the gravel routes, but there was probably like, it was a 60-mile or maybe it was just a 40-mile ride, but there was like 60 cues in it. There was a lot of turns, and all of them were in the middle of nowhere. There was no, like often there wasn't even signs. So to know your next, there's a cue that can tell you your next turn's coming in 3/4 of a mile, and then your turn's coming up, and then your next cue is going to be in 3 miles. So it made me be able to look up and enjoy where I was a lot, so much more, rather than having to look down or go back to my phone or my GPS and keep checking, am I on track? Do I go right or left here? It was telling me, turn right. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's a new sales pitch we're going to roll with is don't look at your phone, just listen.
And I didn't keep both, because I was in the middle of nowhere and I'm not used to riding in Illinois, so I wasn't sure if I was going to be experiencing trucks or there's a lot more... loose dogs are a thing there,
yeah,
a
mm-hmm.
lot on the for farms. Sure. Yeah. And so I like to keep one ear open so that I can. So I kept one earbud in, and it just told me exactly where to go. And I was in love. I was like, this is amazing. Yeah.
It's a great feature. I would agree with that. How do you guys have, you work with Scenic Bikeways, and Alex was sort of gave you a little bit of an intro in her part about the work with Oregon Department of Parks and Rec.
Yeah, so they, you know, need to plan your route somewhere. So they plan them on our site. They are part of our ambassador program, which is kind of, you know, Scenic Bikeways are the best of the best rides in an area. And our ambassador program is it's kind of the same thing, but kind of on a worldwide basis, there's great, you know, same thing, great routes, great experiences, but we don't know that in the office. Like, we don't know anything about anything other than a little bit here in Portland. But you do, because you live in that community, or you do because you work at the bike shop in X town. So it's a kind of a more content-rich program to let people showcase the best of the best routes in their area. If I'm coming in for a weekend, what are the two routes that I have to hit? Where's the best cheeseburger I need to get? What's the best beer, etc.?
And are those routes, when people research that, highlighted somehow, or like differentiated against the sort of weekend warrior?
Yeah, so there's they get special designation in our find page on the website. So if you search for, I'll use the Sacramento thing. Always, if you search for Sacramento routes on our find page, you'll get like 82,000 results. But the top, I believe, five will be Visit Lodi, because they're in the ambassador program and they're vetted. They have great pictures. They have all the information that you're going to need to have a successful trip on one of those routes.
Yeah, the other, I mentioned the other time when I ended up on a scenic bikeway that was actually outside of Bend. I'd mountain bike Bend a lot, but I hadn't done much road riding, and it was amazing. It literally took me maybe, we had a few hours of daylight left. It was the end of the day. We were going to just look at maps, and it's like, okay, I'm just going to pull out my Riva GPS and search around me. And the scenic, it just happened to be where my Airbnb was a mile from where the scenic route started.
Did you do the Twin Bridges scenic bikeway?
I think so. It's
a big loop.
It's like a lollipop type thing.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that's it.
And it goes right out of town and drops down through that. Yeah. So, but I was able to load that ride on. And within, so instead of it taking me 45 minutes and having to cut down on my ride time, I was able to just find it. And yeah, it's what you guys have done is a really, really useful tool, especially if people are traveling to a place and they just decide, oh, I've got an hour to go on a ride.
Yeah.
What's around me? You can actually find routes that are really close to you to do it that way too.
Yeah, so, and that kind of brings up an interesting point, because we sort of stumbled upon that. And so we've probably for the last 6 or 7 years, you could boil down our mission and vision, which wasn't really written down, but essentially, since we were such a small company, we all shared the same idea, and it was get more people going on better bike rides more often. You know, so that kind of covers the whole gamut of, we should grow and make sure people have a good time when they go out on a bike, and if people have limited time, give them a better route. You know,
yeah,
and prepare them in advance. Give them the elevation profile so they know that this can be too hard for me. It's gonna be miserable, or this is gonna be too easy. I should look for something more challenging. And what we realized is, by building tools centered around the consumer and along with that mindset, we ended up with like just most of the cycling events in the country, most of the bike clubs in the country. And I've only recently been comfortable by using the word most, because we actually talk to them now. But we're just using our software, and we sort of took it for granted or didn't think about it. And then in the last couple of years, we're like, hey, let's be the technology backbone for the service end of the cycling industry. People that are serving riders, like, they don't know how to make cool maps. They don't know how to do navigation. They're not going to make a mobile app, and I don't want to see them waste money on that stuff.
Right, and if they do, there might be one person who does,
right,
but that person is maybe really geeked out on one portion of it instead of the rounded view you're coming at with your app.
But they are experts in their content. You know, that's what they're good at. They know the best routes. They know all the things you need to know. They know the logistics. And so we've really kind of retooled and been like, let's identify those really incredibly important power users, like the tourism agencies or the bike clubs or the event operators, and give them better tools and talk to them and dedicate part of our support team to just dealing with those folks, and give them, basically just give them a better soapbox than they currently have.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's good.
So what are your favorite routes right now? How about?
And do you use two or one wheel?
Yes.
There is video of the unicycle on Newberry.
How big a wheel is that?
It's actually a fairly big one. It's a 29-inch wheel.
Okay. Have you seen those two British guys on YouTube touring in Pakistan?
I have. And I think he's...
What are they on?
I think he's on a 29er.
Okay. It looks huge.
So there's a guy in the Portland area who owns a company called Serious Juggling, and he does the STP every year on a 36-inch unicycle. And before I got my 29-inch one, I actually went there one day after a stop at Haile Pele, if anyone's been there. It's a great spot. And he let me ride his 36-inch unicycle, and I must say, it's a challenge.
Right.
It's a very big wheel.
It's a huge wheel.
I mean, lots of favorite routes. To tie it into the overnighter or the sub 24-hour thing, I like riding out to Thunder Island and staying the night. And
where is
back.
Thunder Island?
So Cascade Locks.
Oh, okay. For listeners who aren't from Oregon, that's in the Oregon Scenic Gorge area.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So it's 50 miles one way, so 100 miles round trip. You can utilize the Springwater Corridor for the first 10 to 12 miles. Alternatively, you could take the MAX out and cut down on a little bit of that as well. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of go Troutdale up to Vista House, then back down on the old Columbia Highway. Mm-hmm. So you never touch Highway 84.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last six or so miles are on the Columbia Gorge Path that doesn't have any cars. It's just pedestrians and bikes. And then you camp down on the island. There's Thunder Island Brewing right there.
Nice.
So you don't really have to worry about, you know, removing barriers to getting into overnighters or whatever. You don't necessarily have to carry any food or cookware or anything because you have all that right there in the little town.
Mm-hmm.
You can use public transit if you want. You cannot do that. It's
love
great.
It.
Yeah, we'll do it on, you know, a Friday. And I would recommend, like, on a Friday, the Multnomah Falls and stuff really isn't slammed until the weekends.
Right.
So you can get out on a Friday. There's nobody on the road. It's super awesome. And then you can come back in the morning and you're going the opposite direction of everybody coming out to the falls. So you've got your side of the road all the way back up exactly where you came. It's highly recommended.
Nice.
And Zach, what about you?
I'll use this as an opportunity to give a shout out to Ryan Francesconi and Ron Lewis, the two gentlemen who run a group called Our Mother the Mountain, and they have a mailing list called Unpaved. So, but I would Google Our Mother the Mountain. They have a website where they bring their content together and promote this ride series. And you don't sign up, you just show up at a time in a parking lot or something. And there's like 60 people there, and they all depart and do this route that that Ryan and Ron and some other folks put together. But they have all their routes just documented impeccably on our website and on their website, and it's the best routes I've ever done in my life. Like, hands down, if you want to go, and they're focused
They're challenging.
They're challenging, but I will say two things.
Listeners, one, be warned, they are advanced.
They're more on the gravel end, so if you want to be on pavement, then don't listen to this. But if you do want to go on a gravel route, they are challenging, but you can retool them. Like, Kevin and I, for the last 2 years, have done one of their rides, which they run in September, called Ripple Brook. And we do a much easier version of it. And it's just so scenic and beautiful. Like,
which
I can't
is your easier version on Rides with GPS, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Is it called the easier version?
It is. It's Ripple Brook Backroads easy version.
Yeah. mine is for babies, is what I call mine.
So if folks want to learn more about you guys and what you're up to and Ride with GPS, how would they connect with you via websites, social media?
RideWithGPS.com, same thing on social media. You know, come sign up and check things out, and then info@RideWithGPS.com, send us an email. We love talking to our people. Gets us good ideas, gets us feedback, helps us improve. And we have, you know, we have a community. We like to engage with our community.
Great. Thanks for coming today, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show from Portland, Oregon, which airs on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Tori Bortman, Alon Robb, Alex Zimmerman, and myself, Terry Campbell. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests, Alex Phillips from Oregon State Parks, and Zach Hamm and KPR from Ride with GPS. We'll be back next month with more great bike news. Until then, keep those wheels down.
And that does it for the bike show for Wednesday, the 26th. No, it's not the 26th. It's August 2nd. Coming up next, Jazz Lives. Nick is waiting in the wings to sit in the hot seat. And I'm going out into the heat. In the meantime, James is going to bring you the KBOO Noon News. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. KBOO Portland.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. In Georgia, T.T. Dangerfield, a transgendered woman, was found in her car outside of an apartment complex, suffering from multiple gunshot wounds. She later died in Grady Memorial Hospital. Police said to the local Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "At this time, we have no information that points to the shooting being the result of our victim being transgendered." Dangerfield, 32, is the 16th trans person to be murdered in the United States this calendar year. In local news, the OHSU Center for Embryonic Cell and Gene Therapy has announced a scientific breakthrough after correcting a faulty gene that causes a heart condition, which is the most common cause of sudden death in young athletes. The same technique could be used against other genes that cause diseases, including some breast and ovarian cancers. Though Congress has enacted barriers to such genetic trials, and the National Institute